India is obviously a massive economy, similar population to that of China, high growth, in investing a lot in its infrastructure, financial systems that aren't terribly developed, meaning that the banking system is weak. You have a crisis that started years ago within the non-banking financial world. You've got public bond market that isn't really developed. You have very few foreign banks that are involved in India. You have a lot of regulatory obstacles to be investing in India. But at the same time, you've got a very vibrant economy. You've got a lot of mid-cap enterprises that are independent, that are managed by smart entrepreneurs, and that need financing.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, and my name is Darren Rockman, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And with me today, Michelle Lowy. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Darren. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too. Michelle is CEO and co-founder of SC Lowy, which is a specialist Asian special situations fund, which he founded together with Shin Lee in 2009. Michelle is a pioneer in Asian credit markets. He's been in that market for longer than he or I think anybody else can remember. I think it's a quarter of a century in Asian private credit markets. He was at Cargill, where he built their Asia Value Investment Group. And then afterwards, he spent a decade at Deutsche Bank in their APAC Strategic Investments Group as well. We're going to focus in on China, Asia, and the broader region. Let's start with this. Michelle, China's been going through a reopening post the COVID lockdowns. How is that impacting the Chinese economy, the global economy, and particularly on the demand side and GDP?
Yeah. So obviously the reopening of China has a major impact on China, Asia, the rest of the world, on GDP, a very strong impact on China GDP, but also because you're starting off a very low.
So where are we seeing that come out? Are we seeing Chinese people go off, shop, buy to start to reopen?
You're in Hong Kong, where we are headquarters, where we have our headquarters. We are starting to see the borders being open, meaning that you can meet for business. And when you meet, you can negotiate transactions. So certainly there are tourists and consumption, and we are starting to see this in the rest of the world. But it's also just the ability to have meetings and discuss business and discuss future.
And how do you see that play out during the rest of this year? Are we talking about a full reopening of the economy? What do you think is going to be the impact on GDP in China?
Yeah, I think that when you talk China, it's important to keep in perspective the fact that it's not just COVID, right? But the government and the leadership of Xi Jinping has changed the equation quite a bit. And even in a pre-COVID world, the relationship between China and the rest of the world, the relationship between China and Hong Kong, or whether Hong Kong is part of China or not, those are all topics and changes that start to play out pre-COVID. And in a post-COVID world and with some form of reopening, there is still a major question mark as to what is the role of China within our Western slash capitalistic world and what place they want to take there.
From your perspective of someone that's watched the China come out of being a very backward country to where it is today and now seeing almost the U-turn as China perhaps starts to turn its back against the West. What does that mean for the global economy? Does that mean that the impact of China is going to be limited to its immediate trading partners?
Well, yes, most probably. Ultimately, that's been the role of China in the last 20 years. China has been a trading partner with Europe, with the US, and there has been limited political role. I think that's what's really changed in the last few years is the decision of China to not only occupy a significant economic place, but also occupy a political place.
So I want to get back to that in a little bit. What we're seeing in the West are the rumblings of recession. We're not seeing it yet, but with interest rates you know, elevated and staying elevated, it would seem, certainly for the moment, the pressure on the US economy and Europe and even places here like Israel is growing. Does China come to the world's rescue as it has in the past, as it reopens and GDP starts to pick up again? Does it give the world a shot in the arm that the world needs in order to keep global growth at a reasonable pace?
I don't think so. I think that while it will have a positive impact in terms of demand and travel, we are not back to where we were a few years ago. Remember that in many ways, a lot of growth in the West was driven by deflation that was led by China. And now, not necessarily not the case. We are looking at China that's moving, trying to move up in the food chain and trying to do more value-add production, right? So I think that it'll have a positive impact, but then the reopening of China will also have a negative impact on inflation and on shipping rates and on commodity price and everything else.
So that could actually create more of an inflationary impulse, which means that interest rates are going to have to stay higher for perhaps even longer.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Okay. One of the big focuses over the last year in China has been the real estate market there and the troubles that the real estate that are overgrown, you know, bridges to nowhere. Choose your keyword. What's happening now? Is that market being restructured or is that still ahead of us?
It's still in the middle of being completely restructured. You have to remember that the real estate sector in China used to represent a third of Chinese GDP. And that's direct construction development. If you look at all the ramifications, it's probably greater than that. Within the real estate sector in China, about two-thirds was private enterprise, only one-third public enterprises. And the biggest change that we've witnessed, and in my opinion, the biggest desire by the Chinese administration was to control the real estate sector a lot more. And how do you control the real estate sector? By moving a lot of wealth from private enterprise into public enterprise. And we're still in the middle of that process. You still have about, close to $300 billion of Chinese property bonds that, have defaulted and that are in the middle of restructurings. And even for those that have been restructured, they could qualify as zombie restructuring because you can close a restructuring, you can term some debt and you're performing again because you're not paying interest. But ultimately, until you sell apartments, you're not generating cash flow, you can't support your debt. And today, there is this very slow restart of buying interest by the Chinese consumer, and that's going to take a very long time to take place.
Right. Is this in any way akin to what we saw in the West in 2008 with massive overbuild, affordability problems, and buyers who suddenly just had to leave the market and perhaps never came back? It took 6 or 7 years for those problems to get ironed out. And during that period of time, we had a period of very slow growth in the US, certainly. Are we seeing similar things happening in China right now?
I don't think so. I think the situations are very different. While there's been a lot of speculation in China, and some of the speculation was led by accumulation of debt, I think that the changes in China are much deeper because it's a political decision to change the landscape so that the central government can control development much better. So there is a social desire as well to maintain prices and to stop inflation. So there is a social aspect, but ultimately it's much more of a political decision than an economic decision that we witnessed in the West.
And what are the ramifications of that change in political mood? Certainly for investors and for people like yourself who are playing credit markets in Asia. Now you have, whenever politicians are making decisions, clearly it makes it more difficult for rational investors to understand where things are going.
Yeah, to be perfectly frank, for us at SCLOE, it does not change a great deal because China is a market where we've never invested much. We are much larger in many other Asian economies, but China is the one large economy where we've always limited to our investments to the minimum. And we have because ultimately the legal framework isn't there to protect debt investors, as we've seen again in the last few years. But this was unexpected. It was unexpected. The overall impact was not expected by us, of course. But the fact that you can't enforce, you can't foreclose as a creditor. This is nothing new to us, which is why we are not heavy investors in China and will not be in the foreseeable.
You're talking about a region which is a massive part of the investment universe, where somebody who is as close to China as one can possibly be, main offices out of Hong Kong, you just hop, skip, a jump over the border. For someone like you, you look at it and say, I don't really want to play this game.
Exactly, right? You look at other economies from Korea to Australia to India, you've got an insolvency regime, you've got creditors' rights, you've got enforceability. It doesn't work the same way in each country. Some are slower, some are faster, but ultimately, you've got a pretty good sense of where you stand and what you can expect, which is rarely the case in China.
Okay, so let's now move to these other parts of Asia. And as an ex-Australian, I saying Australia's part of Asia, you know, I don't know about that. But okay, Michelle, we'll give it to you. So you're in the business of buying special or writing and buying special situations debt. What opportunities do you see in the Asian market in the areas that you concentrate on, as we've discussed, your South Korea, and India and the like? What are some of the risks that are coming about?
Yeah. So for us, the biggest opportunity geographically is India. India is obviously a massive economy, similar population to that of China, high growth, investing a lot in its infrastructure, financial systems that aren't terribly developed, meaning that the banking system is weak. You have a crisis that started years ago in the within the non-banking financial world. You've got public bond market that isn't really developed. You have very few foreign banks that are involved in India. You have a lot of regulatory obstacles to be investing in India. But at the same time, you've got a very vibrant economy. You've got a lot of mid-cap enterprises that are independent, that are managed by smart entrepreneurs, and that need financing. And that's a big focus for us, because on one end, you've got limited competition, massive economy, quality enterprises, if you're quite selective, and a legal process, a legal framework that works.
Let's focus in on that. You've mentioned this now twice, that the importance of having a stable legal framework. In a place like India, is there a very clear way of vendors like you getting out with your shirt on when the going gets rough?
Yeah, there is. There really is. You need to be patient. It could take you a lot longer than it does in other economies, right? You look at one end of the scale, Australia or Korea, where, you know, in 6 months to a year, you can complete the restructuring, you can foreclose. In India, it could take you 3 to 5 years, but you will get there. And the fact that you can get there, that's what gives you the leverage. Because the person that sits on the other side of the table knows very well that you can get there. And simply that fact means that we got to sit down and talk.
Playing ball.
Exactly.
And if we move beyond sort of India for a minute to some of the other markets you operate in, let's look at South Korea. Is the situation there similar? Limited availability of capital, stable legal framework?
Korea is a different story. Korea is a fairly insular market. I'm very fortunate that my business partner of the last 25 years is Korean, and that's the main reason and why we've been very successful in Korea. So Korea, on the one end, is super well developed when you talk about insolvency regime, accounting standards. You feel very comfortable and you are in a very sophisticated Western-style economy, and where actually the insolvency regime is way stronger and faster than it would be in continental Europe, for example. And I would say on par with the UK. But at the same time, everything is in Korean. Every discussion is in Korean. Every documentation is in Korean. Right. There's very few foreigners.
Difficult for foreigners to get involved, right?
So it's very difficult for foreigners. And we're fortunate that we are foreigners, but we are also local, and we've got a very, very good team in Seoul and my main business partners. So that puts us at a strong advantage. But yeah, we love investing in Korea. There's not enough for us to do.
If I sort of circle back to the China question, when you look at an economy like South Korea or Taiwan or Singapore, how do you take into account the China factor and the political and particularly the bipolar move that the Asia and the West are moving towards?
I turn back the question to you. How do you take into account the impact on the US, the UK, Israel, continental Europe, whatever? You know, obviously, impact is slightly more significant on the likes of South Korea.
Yeah.
But ultimately, Korea has a business partner, China, in the same way that the UK or the US has a business partner. And for Korea, the rest being a very export-driven economy, the rest of the world, including China, is super important. But the fact that China is in your neighborhood and is closer in a global economy is slightly more relevant, but only slightly compared to other economies. And the way we take that into account is by simply accepting the fact that we are in a recessionary environment, that there's probably more bad news than good news that are going to come through the pipe. And right. When we look at a corporate, we expect that performance tomorrow will be worse than performance today. And if despite that, it's a good investment opportunity, then it's a good investment opportunity.
So switching that now to your core business, which is you're a lender, right? You're a private lender.
Yeah.
For the better part of the last 15 years, private lenders have been hugely attractive to investors because the alternative, you know, standard bonds, bank deposits, money market funds, earned you, I think that the word was nothing. But that's changed. And so the spread between what an investor could earn in a risk-free or low-risk or highly diversified, very liquid yielding instrument, like a bond fund, and what they could get from many private lending investments where, you know, the investment was locked up, it's more difficult to execute, that spread has narrowed. How do you see that in your business, with your in discussions with your investors, and frankly, in discussions with the people that you lend money to?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So first of all, in what I do, the spread hasn't really changed, right? When interest rates were at zero, we were generating 10-12%. Now we're generating mid-teens while interests are at 5%. Personally, I'd rather generate 15% because that means that the discount rate at which I'm discounting back the cash flows is a lot higher, meaning that the dark price I'm paying is a lot lower, meaning that the margin of safety I've got in what I do is significantly greater, right? So if you assume that you're going to get 100 in 3 years and you discount that back at 20%, you buy the asset at 56 cents on the dollar, which is way better than, you know, when you buy it at 75, because if you get some of your assumption wrong, you're still going to make money. So from my perspective, that's better. Now, from a corporate world perspective, that's difficult because obviously financing yourself in the mid-teens can only work for a short period of time. And that's often what we do, right? We tend to be in a business where we're not lending for 5 years. We are bridging a problem, right? Because a company can't afford to pay our cost of capital for 5 years. Otherwise, if they do, it often means that, you know, they're going to pay
back. There's no business left when you're finished.
Exactly.
And are you starting to see pressures build up, not in the companies necessarily that you're lending to, but some of the weaker companies as these high interest rates are now really, you know, stressing their profit?
Yeah, no, that we are starting to see. We look at the number of deals where we're signing non-disclosure agreements to get access to private information. This is exploding in the last few months. And the number of corporates that have difficulties refinancing themselves is huge. Because whether you're financing with bank debt or with bonds, the cost of capital has gone up so much in the last few months that this is really starting. And we think that the next 2-3 years are going to be extremely interesting for what we do, because it's only going to get worse. Yeah. Meaning that there will be a lot more attractiveness for our pools of capital.
So more demand, a higher quality companies coming to you because they haven't got other options and probably a limited supply.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, when you look at the regions within Asia where you see the greatest financial strength, where you want to be playing, and maybe some of those where you wouldn't go even if someone gave you a free business class ticket, what do you divide up the countries between the strong and perhaps the weak?
First of all, stepping back 1 second, right? We're looking at Asia and Europe, and certainly continental Europe at the moment is starting to be really attractive. We got a large presence in Italy, for example, where we are starting to see some really attractive deal flow. But going back to Asia for a moment, for me, investing, it's all about being opportunistic. So we are investing in the countries where we've got boots on the ground, we've got a good knowledge of framework, law firms, we've gone through insolvencies before, often with corporates that we've known for a number of years, and access to good information, and then hard assets and collateral. Right. Ultimately, we live in a world that's highly unpredictable, from a corporate performance standpoint, and having hard assets to underpin your downside and provide you protection is what we look for at this stage in the cycle.
Often the people in your shoes were lending against real estate as a sort of the hardest of hard assets, if you will. With interest rates up so much, how do you value that real estate? How do you think about what the breakup value is if you actually have to take possession?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. And it's obvious that cap rates are going up and are correlated to interest rate, which should destroy some value within real estate. And that generally you'll see income going up to compensate that and rental income, but we're not in an environment where that's going to play out. So I think that you need to go for prime assets and you need to have a good margin of safety.
Right. Okay. Very good.
If you think that something was worth 100 yesterday, and it's probably worth 80 today and you're lending 50.
Right.
Right. And it's not going to half.
Okay. And from a high net worth investor perspective, and we'll round off with this. If you were, you know, you're sitting right there and you understand the markets in which you're operating very closely, but for someone at a greater distance, how would you, of course, Michelle, I'm giving you the opportunity to pitch your fund, but how do you play Asia? What's the best way for an investor to take advantage of some of the growing Asian countries, China as well? And what wouldn't you do?
If you think about the various types of products that are available, I'm biased, but you know, I believe that private equity today, with a lot less liquidity, a lot less visibility, the exit of the public markets not being there, it's limited visibility on growth, political issues. I think that private equity, you're being too exposed in a period of uncertainty. And so within the private markets, I believe that private debt is way more attractive than private equity at this point in the cycle, because you have the high inflation, the political uncertainty, and the ability to generate 15-20% doing private debt. Why would you want to do private equity?
And for those who wanted to be more liquid, what would your preference be?
If you want to be more on the liquid side, I'm not the right person to talk about the public equity markets.
Okay, fair enough.
And the problem of the public bond market in Asia is that it's still largely dominated by China. And there you are taking equity risk. So you could generate significant performance, but be ready for the ride and the
ride of your life. Okay, fantastic. Exactly. Michelle Lowy from SC Lowy, speaking to us from Milan. Are you in Milan at the moment?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Where the weather is looking glorious through the back window there. Thanks very much for being on Definitely Uncertain. Really appreciate you being
here. Very welcome.
And yeah, we look forward to speaking to you again. And for all of you out there, thanks for tuning in. And there'll be more episodes coming your way sometime soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.